Donc,
Ok, ça va.
oh.
Bon. Ouais. Tout calme. Ah.
Good evening. This is Pauline Lamotang, president of Pine Tree Guide Dog Users, and I'd like to welcome everyone to our fall membership meeting. Today is November 1st, 2023. And without further ado, I'd like to turn it back over to Jim to introduce our special guest for tonight.
Thank you, Pauline. This is Jim Kutch. It's my pleasure and honor to introduce our guest speaker this evening, somebody that I've known for quite a while, and probably many of you, either on the call or listening to the recording, know him as well. And that is no other than our special guest this evening, Lucas Frank. He is a certified O&M specialist. He's a GDMI, guide dog mobility instructor. He's a recent recipient of the Ken Lord Award, the highest award that the International Guide Dog Federation gives to any of its staff members or who are in organizations that belong to that organization. And he's recently joined me in the Retiree Club. So welcome to that, Lucas, and welcome to this meeting. This evening, he's going to share with us his extensive knowledge and his experiences about safety and walkability for blind and low vision pedestrians. Lucas, over to you.
Thanks, Jim. It's good to hear your voice. And hi, everybody. A lot of people I know here. just wonderful to see you all again. And just let me say, particularly to those of you in Maine, it's been a rough couple of weeks for y'all. And I hope none of you had personal connections with any of those people who were killed or wounded. But that's just been south of the whole country, and I'm really sorry that you had to go through that. So I was asked to talk about sort of access and what's going on the streets, and it's really a good time for that because there's some significant changes happening in the regulatory space right now. Meaning in particular the passage, as it were, of what's called PROAG, or the Public Rights of Way Access Accessibility Guidelines. But we'll get to that eventually. Going back way back when, you know, it's if you think about it, I recently watched a film that was made at the Heinz Veterans Administration. I know Jim Martin is on the call. He's an old mobility instructor. Jim, did you ever see The Long Cane, the black and white movie that was made
I
with,
don't remember that.
you don't
I don't
remember?
remember that.
Yeah, it was made at Heinz in like 1950, and what's really, it's about the Heinz Veterans Administration program. And I wonder if you can find it on YouTube these days. Maybe you can, but it's really
Probably.
cool looking at the way people are traveling back then. I mean, think about it. Those of you who are a little older, I think many of us are, you can remember those old V8s on the corner, you know, thump, 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 thump. You know, listening to that traffic, I mean, that was a piece of cake, wasn't it? You know, okay, go when the light changes. How will I know when the light changes? When the cars go, thump, 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 I think they're going, you know. I think we got it, you know. That was pretty straightforward and pretty simple. And I think an awful lot of people figured that out on their own without mobility instructions. It was a piece of cake. Then things started to get a little tougher in a lot of different ways, right? I think the first big change was the advent of right turn on red in the 70s. And that came about because of the oil shock. There was an oil shortage. There was political pressure coming out of the Middle East. Doesn't that sound familiar? Driving up the prices and the availability of gasoline. And so they decided that wasting fuel on a corner for waiting for a light to change when nothing was coming was a wasteful practice. And so they allowed right turn on red. And of course, the implication, that the thing that made it more difficult for people who are blind or visually impaired, was that before right turn on red, when that car next to you started to go, you were pretty sure that you were at the beginning of, quote, fresh green, unquote, going across street because nothing could move. When all of a sudden you began to have right turn on red, well, then you had to throw out the right turn information because that car might actually be turning on red, which was legal. It also made it more difficult because if you were listening across the street, the car across the street that was starting up that was turning left could be making a right turn on red for it. And so the complication became that much more difficult. At the same time, as the country grew and our population grew, you began to see wider and wider streets, which meant that it was increasingly critical that you leave pretty early in the crossing space. Again, in the 70s, beginning in the 70s, you began to see the computerization of intersection controls. So prior to the early 70s, intersections were generally run by, in effect, clocks. You know, so there were clocks, heavy duty clocks contained within cabinets, and the gears would actually, literally gears would turn, and the light would be set to go for a certain number of seconds on the main street, and then a gear would click, and you could off. How many of you remember those gears clicking when it would go ka-thunk, and then the light would change for the other direction? Well, guess what? Those clunks went away with computers. They don't clunk at all. But what also happened was that, you know, whereas in the early days, you could have what are called two phases. The main street went, the side street went, the main street went, the side street went. Pretty simple. You could count it off. Sometimes there was actuation, but you know what actuation was then? It was a big spring set into the roadway. So there was a bar that would be cut into the roadway. It would have a spring underneath it. A car would roll over the spring, and that would make the light change. Well, number one, to do that required a huge construction project. And number two, it was pretty rare. So with computerization, all of that changed. You began to have computers that instead of intersections, that instead of having two phases, A street, then B street, you could have now up to 16 phases, sometimes more. So because the intersection is equipped with sensors that are much more complex than the old spring that the car sat on, and the intersection is in effect intelligent, so that it is making decisions on what street to allow to go. So how do we get equal? How do we break even here? What happens with that? Well, beginning in the late 90s, a group of advocates, people who are blind or visually impaired, mobility instructors, began to get involved with the traffic engineering community. Up until that time, there was no language in any of the federal manuals that said anything about creating accessible signals for people who are blind or visually impaired. What that meant was that there were two flavors of traffic engineers. You didn't know that they came in flavors, but they do. One flavor was the type of traffic engineer that said, when a blind person came to them and said, I can't get across this street. Do you have any kind of accessible signal that will get me across the street? And that flavor of traffic engineer would say, let me check the manuals. No, there's nothing in the manuals. I'm sorry, I can't do anything for you. And the other flavor of traffic engineer with response to the same question would say, there's nothing in the manuals. I can do anything I want. And what they would do is go into the cabinet and pull out a klaxon horn or something and say, how about if when the light changes, I make this thing go wah, and then you'd know. And the person would go, that's great. Let's do that. And so that would happen, and people would be able to get across whatever street that happened to be. But there was no federal regulation. Beginning in the mid-90s, we began to do a lot of research to develop what became and has become an American standard for accessible pedestrian signals. And with the passage of PROAG, that's now going to become mandatory. How mandatory? What do I mean mandatory? Mandatory is complicated. Okay, one piece of mandatory is that in new construction, if they put in an intersection, they have to make it accessible. They have to bring it up to standard. They have to put in accessible signals in the right place. The other side of that is much more common and much more complex, and that is at intersections that already exist and are not accessible. Then what happens is that an alteration of that intersection may or may not trigger the installation of accessible pedestrian signals. This is where the rubber meets the road, and this is unsettled territory. This is still a little bit of the Wild West, because there's a lot of fighting and a lot of money at stake, and depending on how you define what constitutes an alteration of an intersection to put in an accessible signal. Is it if you change a light bulb in a traffic light? Let's say a light blows out, you have to change a light bulb in the traffic light. Does that mean you have to put in accessible signals? Well, you know, I might say, gee, that would be great, but the people who run the town spend the money, and the traffic engineers are going to say, uh-uh, that's not major enough. So what is? And that's still in the courts. Essentially, the Public Rights of Way Access Advisory Accessibility Guidelines have been passed, but they have not been implemented yet because they're still sitting with the Department of Justice, where the big fight is over what constitutes an alteration that triggers an update to an intersection, if that makes sense to you. I think that will be that will shake out in the next couple of years. It goes from the DOJ to the Department of Transportation, the DOT, and then it ends up being sort of retrofitted into the federal manuals, and then it will start to happen fairly quickly. And again, when I say fairly quickly, you know, it takes a while for this type of change to be instituted on the street. It's not like you wave a magic wand and all of a sudden there are accessible signals everywhere. But there's enough precedent now in the courts that I think this is actually going to happen. But again, where it will happen in an individual town, and et cetera, you know, that's a question of budgets, priorities, all kinds of things. But certainly the legal framework is in place. Recently, New York City lost a case and it has had to do a major project to install accessible signals in a large scale fashion. And they're actually doing a pretty good job of it. Chicago lost a similar case and they're not doing a good job of it. They're having a hard time figuring out how to do it and comply. And there's probably going to be further legal action there. So, you know, there's a lot happening in this space. But in the meantime, there you are in the street corner, you got to cross the damn street. Now what do you do? Well, you know, there are certainly problems and things that are difficult. We talked about right turn on red being one. And nowadays, also at some of these major intersections, which have all the flexibility that we touched on earlier, you need to interact with the intersection. If you don't, you can get yourself into trouble. If there's a push button to cross a major roadway and you don't push it, there are consequences to that. What you're doing when you push a pedestrian push button is you are not making the light change. In other words, when you push a button, the light doesn't change right away. I think a lot of this is common knowledge, but it doesn't hurt to restate it. What you're doing is you're telling the intersection that you're there, and that as the intersection works its way through its cycle, assigning movements to one set of vehicles going north and then giving priority to cars coming south or then east, it will, when in the crossing that applies to you, it will apply a pedestrian timing instead of a vehicular timing. What does that mean? You may have noticed that cars move faster than people. So because of all the sensors that we've been talking about, let's imagine that you're waiting to cross a major roadway. The parallel street is next to you on your left. Everybody good? Say yes or no. If you're not muted, just wave or something. Okay. So got some waves. If you don't push that button and there's one car next to you on that parallel street that's going to go straight through the intersection, because of the sensors, will know that car is there, and it will assign 7 seconds to that car to get across that street. So what will happen is the light will change. That car will get the green light. It will have 7 seconds to get into and through the street, then the light will go to yellow and red and green for the other way. 7 seconds, if it's a major street, might be as much as 8, 9, or 10 seconds with all that change stuff. It may not be enough for you to get across, let's say, a six-lane intersection. So what happens when you push the button is that you're telling the computer that the intersection, that there's a pedestrian waiting to cross that street. And so it will overlay a pedestrian timing on that same crossing, so that instead of getting 7 seconds to cross the street, you will get 7 seconds of walk time plus an allocated period of time that is the flashing don't walk, the flashing red hand. Everybody knows what I'm talking about when I say that. What happens is the walk interval, which is the visual display of the walking person, will typically be 7 seconds. And that's by regulation. How long the light flashes with the flashing red hand is calculated based on the width of the street divided by 3.5 feet per second, which is actually quite slow. Okay, so in other words, let's make it 4 feet per second just to make it easy to multiply and divide with. That if you had an 80-foot wide street, which would be about 8 lanes, okay, you would have 7 seconds of walk, okay, and then 20 seconds, so 80 feet divided by 4, of flashing don't walk. Okay, so you would have 7 seconds of walk, 20 seconds of flashing don't walk, and then a few seconds of change to get across that street, which is way different from the 7 seconds that the single car got, right? So that's why it's important to push buttons when you have to cross, in particular, a major roadway, because you're telling the intersection you're there and you need a pedestrian timing. There are other factors that can make that crossing relatively concerning, okay? One of the things that's been happening over the last few years is that people, you know, how many of you, you're all, this is Pine Tree Guide Dog users, so you're all guide dog users. How many of you have, you can unmute yourselves for a second, have more than one person in your town who is a guide dog user? Maine, there's probably not a lot. Yeah, Ginger's got Jim. That's no fair accounting. No fair.
Okay. I think there are a couple of us in my town.
Couple maybe. But and compared to cane travelers, that's very few. So what happens to the average driver as they're driving through an intersection is they're driving along and they see a person with a dog. And they go, gosh, that's a beautiful golden retriever. And then they go, maybe they go, even if they're stopped at the light looking at you, going, that's a nice looking golden retriever. That is one weird leash, though. God, what is that? A sled? What is that thing? Wait, oh, there goes the light. Light's changing. Is that a sled? That can't be a sled dog. Is that, that's a blind dog. And they're through the intersection and on their way out the other side. Because guide dog users are so rare, it's not automatically in the person's process to go, oh, that's a guide dog. We think it's obvious, but it's not to them. So how do you counteract that? Well, there are all kinds of things that you can do and should think about. One is, if you think about when you give commands to your dogs, I'm sure you were all, whatever school you were from, you were taught to use a hand signal to give a command to your dog, and you probably haven't done one in about 5 years. So, and you, maybe you have stuff in your hands, you just say forward and you don't need it. Maybe it's a small gesture, but from the point of view of the driver, it's certainly invisible, particularly if they're coming from your left and you're gesturing with your right hand. There is no visible cue. Right. So cane travelers, and you may know this, and Jim Martin, any other mobility instructors on the call, you know, you may have been taught to do a false arc of some type. In other words, to take your cane and make an aggressive movement with your cane before you commit your body to actually cross, to give an announcement to the to the driver that I'm about to leave. Some people also advocate using what's called a false step or a half step. So you take a step as if you're going to go to let the driver know again of your intent to cross with your cane. Well, it's hard to do that with a dog. You can't put them in the street and swing them back and forth very easily. But you might be able to make a large gesture with your right hand that indicates, you know, just a forward movement. You have to desensitize your dog to that because the dogs will think of that as a forward command. But you can make a large movements, get people's attention, you know, so that before you actually give the forward command, get that hand out there at shoulder height, and then make sure that everybody's yielded and stopped, and then give your forward command. Because from the driver's perspective, they think the dog makes the decision. They have no idea how this actually works. You say something verbally that they can't hear. There's a hand motion, if at all, that they can't see, and they don't know the significance of it anyway. So some large motion can certainly help that indicate to the driver that you're about to leave. Of course, another thing that you can do to enhance your safety is wear bright clothing. In England, for example, they guide dog travelers wear a bright yellow crossbody stripe and belt that just makes people obvious, that makes people that much more obvious. We at Seeing Eye, we sell a lightweight orange vest that also, for the same reason, be obvious, make large gestures to make yourself clear. And then there's at night, lights can be useful. We sell, and Roughwear sells a light that is designed to go on most American harnesses. There's a silicon clip that slides onto the handle, and it has a rechargeable light. And one of the nice things about that light is that it's truly accessible. It's rechargeable and it's accessible. So as so many of these flashing lights are not accessible, they have positional switches that if you hit it once, it's on. If you hit it twice, it starts flashing. If you hit it three times, it plays Dixie or something, you know, and then four times and you're off. And it's really hard to know where you are in that cycle. The light that Roughwear sells is quite visible. I'm not all that nuts about the clip as it goes on the harness, but certainly the flashing light, you could attach it to your clothing. You could do other things with it. You can get a few of those to make yourself more obvious. And I think that's really a good idea. Of course, it's a good idea to keep your harness in your hand if you're at a corner. So often trucks, even cars, can come around the harness tight, the corner tight, and your dog might very well have to back up away from that, and they will. But if you have the harness in your hand, you're not going to get that notice. One other thing I'll talk about, you'd think that we've talked a lot about right turn on red, and that's an issue. But a friend of mine was not long ago hit by a car turning left at a T intersection. The car was coming up the stem and made a left turn, and she was crossing a street. And you would think from the driver's perspective, she was big as day, and that car hit her. It didn't, she was fine, you know, knocked her down, scared her, and dog was fine too, but it scared the heck out of her. Why did that happen? Well, there's a phenomenon called the A-pillar phenomenon, okay? If you think about a standard sedan car, the two pillars that hold up the roof in front of you, if you're in the passenger or driver's seat, are called the A-pillars. The pillars that are in the middle of the car that hold up the roof in the middle, and maybe if it's got a four-door that the two back doors are attached to, those are called the B-pillars. And the pillars in the rear that hold up the roof in the back around the rear window are called the C-pillars. Now, A-pillars years ago were pretty skinny, okay, because all they did was hold up the roof. They're pretty strong, but they were skinny. Nowadays, they've gotten quite fat. Next time you're sitting in a car, reach up and find that A-pillar, the pillar that'll be in front of you on the right if you're in the front passenger seat. Look at how wide that thing is. Why is it that wide? Because it has airbags in it. All right. So those pillars have gotten much wider. And the impact of that, you know, is such that you, imagine you're, I'm sure you're all familiar with Battery Park and looking at the Statue of Liberty, but I'll do the best I can. So imagine you're standing in Battery Park and you're looking at the Statue of Liberty. Well, is the Statue of Liberty bigger than you? Oh, yeah. Is the Statue of Liberty bigger than a penny? Are you kidding? But yet you can hold that penny in front of your eye and block the entire Statue of Liberty with a penny if you hold it close enough to your eye. Does that make sense to everybody? You can't see it through. Well, when you have an A pillar in a car, you know, let's say you're going to make, you're on the stem of a T and you're going to make a left onto another street. That A pillar is like the penny. And guess what? You're like the Statue of Liberty. Okay. And sometimes that as you start your crossing, the person may not have noticed you because you were hiding behind the A pillar in front of them on their left, holding up the roof right by the steering wheel. And as you start to move, they start to move, and you track right behind that A pillar until you pop out just at the last second. And people can be hit. It's a pretty well-known phenomenon these days. And it is something to be concerned about. How can you beat that? Well, I'm not sure there's a set way, and Mr. Martin may disagree with me on this one, but you know, there's another piece of this picture that I'd like to bring in, and that's bicycles. Some people I know have been hit by bicycles, including people I know, people on this call. They don't hurt quite as much as cars, but they hurt enough. And the one thing I learned in Holland, I lived in Holland, I grew up there, and I've watched people travel in Holland with guide dogs. They all use short canes. They carry canes with them. And that's kind of the rule in Holland. It's not so much just protection. When they cross the street, they hold their cane out horizontally at shoulder height, pointing straight across the street. At the opposite curb. They're not going to use the cane to detect issues on the ground at all, because that's not what it's for. It's an indicator to drivers and passengers and pedestrians that you're blind. Now, it seems to me that a cane, if you had a long cane and you held it halfway down the shaft so it wouldn't be too heavy, you might be able to do that as well. And that length might project on the other side of that A pillar and make you that much more obvious. It would also have the effect of maybe causing bicyclists to yield, which is part of what they do for in Holland. Nothing stops a bicycle as well as a cane in the head. So it's just something to think about. So that's another thing to bear in mind. Sorry, I don't mean to scare everybody to death, but the realities are changing, aren't they? I mean, it's pretty quick between that and the ultra quiet cars, electrics and hybrids. It's a different world out there, and just developing techniques that will keep you that much more safe under those conditions are really, really critical. And I'll stop at that point. Take questions if there are any.
Yeah, Lucas, it's Sue Martin.
Hey, Sue.
In the intersection you were describing with the T intersection, and the car was turning from the stem of the T, turning left, mm-hmm. was the person crossing okay, so if the car turns left, would the person have been crossing from their left to their right?
No, the person was crossing from the top of the T to the stem. So on the driver's, on the left side of the driver. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It was actually a small utility truck owned by Verizon, and unfortunately she didn't sue. I think she'd be living on an island. I mean, it's Verizon after all. But she was crossing. The truck had to go straight ahead and turn left. She was coming from where that car was going to, that truck was going to, coming down to the stem of the T on the car's left.
Okay.
Lucas,
yeah.
Mike Moran here. I was gonna ask you when you started talking about, you know, when we approach a light, an audible signal, what you thought about carrying an identifier cane and then taking it out, number one, to find the pole, and number two, to signal a driver, but also in talking about the A-pillar syndrome, do most people, when they're going to make a left, look to their right so that they're sure a car's not coming, or vice versa?
Yeah. There's been some interesting work done on that recently by Gene Berkwin, trying to get a handle on this. Yes, most, if I'm looking to, because right turn on red is legal, if I'm coming up to, coming to an intersection and I'm intending to turn right, if I, the light is red against me, then it's also, if you're trying to cross that main road, it's also red for you, typically, by the way, right? So, but as I'm starting out from there, I'm going to look left to see if there's a gap in traffic that will allow me to pull in and merge in with the traffic. Again, if the light is red for me as the driver and you're crossing that main roadway, it's also red for you. If you're crossing right in front of me, however, you would likely have the green light going from right to left in front of me. And that does happen where people get distracted by looking too far left. Good drivers, and most people actually do, the research shows that this people actually do this, will tend to look left, glance right, look left, judge their gap and look right. But it certainly can happen that people get clipped that way. Yeah.
Lucas, Nick Chidici.
Nick, how are you?
Well, thanks. I really enjoyed a lot of the information. I can email you. I'd love to get some of the details on some of these new regulations coming. Two quick questions. In Portland, a lot of the lights without an APS have this walk cycle in the middle of the light cycle. So like, it's not on the surge, it's in the middle, so there's no way to know when actually that hand says to walk. And so I often will go just initially following traffic analysis, like, you know, just when the surge happens, but that's not actually when you're supposed to walk, so I've had a lot of close calls, and I don't know what the suggestion for that is. And just my second question is, what can we do when talking with traffic engineers and people to, like, what's the most effective approach in your opinion? I have a bunch of Maine DOT and national TRB people coming to the lab next week, incidentally. So I'd just be curious to, like, what should I be pitching to them?
First of all, to talk about what's going on with that first crossing, I don't know. I'd have to look at an intersection to figure out what's actually happening. But I could suspect that you're dealing with something that might be what's called split phased, okay? Where, we normally, and again, this gets back to the computerized control stuff, right? Or it could just be there's an additional phase there sometimes and sometimes not. So for example, you can have a situation where there are sensors, and the sensors, by the way, nowadays are usually cameras up on top of the mast arms pointed at intersections. So it's not like the old spring loaded days where it went from those to wires in the roadway to now cameras, target acquisition technology. But one of the things that they'll often do is they will split phase an intersection so that we'll have a light. They'll have traffic moving, let's say, north, and the traffic moving south is held until that northbound. So they're not moving concurrently. North and southbound aren't moving concurrently. So that one of the things that can happen is you'll get the northbound phase moving, and perhaps you think, you're maybe across the street, and you think, that's my traffic, and it's not. Your traffic is actually the phase coming after it. But because you don't have an accessible signal there, you don't know that. Well, that's not impossible. Does that seem like it might happen, Nick?
Yeah, that That may be it. It's really hard when I've done it with sighted people. They're like, oh, it's time to go. And I'm like, this doesn't make any sense. It's right in the middle of what I normally wouldn't want to be waiting all this time. So yeah, but that might be it.
That might be
it. And I don't know. And this is something I might connect with you offline, because I've been trying to connect with the traffic engineer here, but and he seems like he wants to figure out how to do things, but he doesn't really know what to do. So
yeah, I'd be happy to help with that if there's any way I can. What was Lucas, the other question?
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
There was another question there, Nick, right?
No, I guess it was just for any of us, like when we are connecting with people in you know, that are in roles of potentially making a difference. What are the things that we can do that might help best get them to think about this? And what should we really be saying? This is where we hope that you're, you know, can put efforts into changing.
Right. Well, I think one of the things that's helpful is having the same language. You know, and this is something that has been an issue in the mobility field for a while, because we had our own lingo. And of course, we taught people who are blind or visually impaired the lingo that we used, and traffic engineers speak a different lingo, and it's quite precise, you know, so that it can be helpful to at least know what their language is and how they say stuff. So, for example, we might say something like, when the cycle's for me, I go such and such. Well, a traffic engineer would say this: the cycle is never for you. Okay, you might have a phase, but you would never have a cycle. The cycle is literally the whole thing. So from the first movement on street one until it goes through all the movements that are attached to street one and all the movements that are attached to street two, and goes around and gets all the way back to the beginning, and that's the full cycle.
Right, good point. Yeah. Right?
So the cycle is made up of phases. All right. And as I said earlier, whereas it used to be in the good old days, an intersection would have two phases, street A, street B. Now an intersection can have up to 16 phases, a really big one. Okay. Not all of which apply all the time. So if there's no cars there, that phase just doesn't happen. Right. But it's still a phase. Right. So the time that you would want to cross the street is when you have the correct pedestrian phasing and the pedestrian phase. So the question is not, when do I go in the cycle? The question is, when is my pedestrian phase? Just as an example of something that you can do to help clarify the language, because a lot of times we talk past each other.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Lucas, this is Bruce Prescott. I find to get their attention at an engineer meeting is to introduce your lawyer that you brought with you.
Or get a law degree yourself. Yeah.
That definitely gets their attention usually.
Well, you know, it's there are a couple things there that are useful. You know, first of all, you need to know who controls the intersection, right? So there are different levels of responsibility. So just if you think about like Presque Isle. Do you know Dennis Connell, by the way?
I do. I worked with him.
Yeah, give him my best if you talk to him. We went to school together.
Sure. He's mentioned you before. Nothing bad, of course.
I don't want to know about that. He's I can tell you some stories about Presque Isle too. Anyway, but
I bet.
Now I forgot. I was having so much a good time thinking about Dennis.
I know. I used to work for Division for the Blind and Visually Impaired, and I took his position when he retired. So,
all right.
As a VR counselor.
What was your question again?
No question. I was just making a comment about the lawyer, introducing your lawyer.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's where we were going with that. Yeah. So there are a couple of things that can be helped. First of all, you need to know the jurisdiction, right? So is it a town road? Is it a county road? Is it a state road? Who's responsible for that? And sometimes they share. So it could be a state road that the county maintains. But you still need to talk to and write to the engineer who's responsible for the intersection. So say it's a county road, you need to figure out who the engineer is. And in Maine, a lot of times it's not a traffic engineer. It can be just a civil engineer who has responsibility for traffic stuff, right?
We have one accessible crosswalk appearance. It goes to nowhere. It's by Walmart. I'm just into a parking lot.
There you go.
Lucas?
Oh.
This is Jean Parker. I know we are acquainted.
We are indeed.
A little bit.
I remember her well.
I grew up partly in Maine, and I also went to the Seeing Eye, and that's how I know Lucas one time. I'm a one dog person, so I hope I'm allowed to be here. I hope it's, you know, I can actually come in here and sit, because it's always a treat, Lucas, to hear you talking. And there are two things that I would ask you to address. One of them is substandard driving practices that have begun, well, that are increasing. I lived in India for 15 years, and I'm here to tell you that some of the driving behavior that I experience or witness would rival what I would find on any given street or intersection in India. And when I came back to this country, I'm sorry?
At least we're competitive. I like that.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's the problem. When I came back to this country, I found the built environment so complex, and I didn't understand what was going on. You know, we have protocols in India that don't really have much to do with mobility and orientation, but are more about how you actually survive crossing a street there. So I'd like you to talk about the increase in substandard driving practices and the lack of consequences for that, and also roundabouts, if you would.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think there are two main culprits, as it were. One is distracted driving, right, which is made possible by cell phones, among other things. People are always involved in their phones when they're driving, which is really sort of deadly. And the people do it all the time, and sometimes they die, sometimes they kill someone, sometimes nothing happens for a long time. So you begin to feel that you're immune to that type of stuff. And I'm honestly as guilty of it as anybody else. I also often see guide dog users using phones while they're working dogs, so it's a little hard to throw stones. In terms of what you do about it, you know, I don't know. I that's why I think that the emphasis on making yourself more obvious in any way that you can is so critical, because there's no cure for that. You know, you just have to be big, bright, and careful. The other thing about using accessible signals is that both the dogs and we were Pavlovian, you know, that the signal says go and boom, we're off the curb, forgetting that not everybody reacts that quickly. There is distracted driving, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And when that signal goes off, you want to just take a second and say, it's your turn. You have a lot of time to get across that street, especially if you're a guide dog user, you're moving quicker than most. And, check that the cars actually stop, as opposed to the signal said they should stop. Roundabouts are a different animal. They're becoming more and more popular in the United States. And I don't know what they were like in India, but in the United States, there's a big one now in Morristown. Now, Jim and Ginger got out just in time. but there's a big one now in Morristown. And they're coming in large numbers. You're going to start seeing them over the next decade. You're going to start seeing them in lots of places. And the reason for that is that they are safe. If you have a regular T-shaped or plus-shaped intersection, let's call it a plus-shaped intersection, that intersection will have a crash history, and that crash history will very likely contain either fatalities or serious injuries. A roundabout just in general for the general population, not talking about people who are visually impaired now, but for the general population, when you put in a roundabout, fatalities and serious injuries at an intersection drop from wherever they were to zero or close to it. And the reason for that is that roundabouts, because of their design, and I'm not talking about, you guys are all from New England, or a lot of you, and you're familiar with the rotaries in Boston. The rotaries in Boston are not roundabouts. I say it again, the rotaries in Boston ain't roundabouts. They're not. They're circular intersections, but they're not roundabouts. So there are some significant differences between the two. And I can talk about that if you'd like me to. But the roundabouts prevent fatalities and serious injuries because they rely upon geometric design to force cars to slow down. So for those of you, let's imagine a wagon wheel. Everybody got the idea of a wagon wheel in there? They got a big old hub and they got four spokes coming into the middle hole for the wheel. Everybody good?
Mm-hmm.
Well, where that spoke comes into the hub is a 90 degree angle, pretty much. It's a circle in the middle, but it's coming in at a very sharp angle. And that's the principle that a roundabout uses. The road comes into that circulating roadway at a sharp angle that forces cars through geometry to slow down. Okay. And then that car has to yield to traffic moving around the circle. That's not true at rotaries, by the way. The Boston Rotary is a different animal altogether, okay? But so those cars have to slow down and then make a right turn. The problem at single lane roundabouts is not that severe. At double lane roundabouts or multi-lane roundabouts, it can be more difficult. And I know there's one in Portland. I've heard about it. Doug Roberts told me about it near the university there in Portland. And the problem at a double lane roundabout is that a car may yield to you, but the second lane may not. So you have to be extremely careful crossing double lane roundabouts. The problem at roundabouts comes in at the exit lane. So there's some good things about roundabouts. Let me give you a couple. When you're crossing a roundabout, you're only crossing one lane at a time, typically. There's exceptions to everything, but you're crossing one lane typically, or one direction of traffic typically anyway. So you're crossing, let's say, from the shoulder to an island in the middle of the roadway approaching the circle. So that and that may be one or two lanes, but it's only coming from one direction. Once you're on the island, you're dealing with the traffic coming from the other direction. So you're only crossing one direction of traffic at the time. Does that make sense to everybody?
Yeah.
Okay. So when you're crossing, when you make a decision to cross a roundabout, the hard part crossing roundabouts is crossing the exit lanes. The hard part crossing a roundabout is crossing the exit lane of the roundabout. If you're crossing the intake lane, okay, that's pretty simple because, again, the geometry of the intersection forces the cars to slow down as they're coming to the roundabout, number one. Number two, where the cars stop is at the margin of the circle where pedestrians cross is behind typically the first car. So those cars are stopped. Another car coming up is yielding because they have a car stopped ahead of them. You're big. You make big motions. You let them know. You take the false step. You make that big arc. Okay. If you're using a guide dog, you make a big gesture like I'm going to go before you go. Make sure those cars yield and you get to the that splitter island. If you have to go from point A to point C, so in other words, not across, just across one street, but you have to go to the diagonal corner, so you have to do two crossings, I would highly recommend that you do it in a clockwise fashion. In other words, cross the intake lane first, then cross the exit lane and do the same thing on your second crossing. Why? Because cars have to slow down to get onto the roundabout, but guess what? They tend to accelerate coming off. Everybody good? If you are standing on the shoulder going to the splitter island, that driver has to take you in, understand what you're doing, and as they're coming around the corner, almost looking over to their right to see where you are. If you do it clockwise, they can see you as they're coming on the splitter island in the middle as they're coming off. And all that same stuff, the big gesture, is more likely to get their attention and allow you to cross that roundabout safely and in an effective manner. Now, what can you do about to make roundabouts safer? I can tell you that in Morristown, we had two sets of countermeasures, and I think they need a third. We were involved in the plan that we couldn't stop the roundabout, but Jim was good enough to let me get involved pretty early in the discussions with the town about this roundabout. It affects one of our routes. It's actually on the Elm Street route at the what was called the Spring Street crossing. They changed the name of the street for some reason. I think they made a mistake, but that's the crossing that is affected by the roundabout. We were able to get one of two types of countermeasures put in there. It's what's put in there is called a pedestrian hybrid beacon. Pedestrian hybrid beacon. That's one type of countermeasure. The other type of countermeasure is called a rectangular rapid flashing beacon, or RFB. Pedestrian hybrid beacon, it always makes me think it's sort of part person and part horse, but it's not. That's not the hybrid part. The pedestrian hybrid beacons. Beacons are a different kind of animal to traffic engineers. This is a jargony thing. A signal, you all understand, one street's red, one street's green. Beacons, when they are typically out, there's no light at all. You can think of it as at a fire station. They have beacons in front of fire stations. If there's no fire, there's no flashing light. When they get a call for a fire, they hit a button and the lights start flashing outside the fire station to let everybody know that the trucks are coming out, right? That's why it's called a beacon. It's out and then it goes on when it's needed. Pedestrian beacons, okay, are out until a pedestrian pushes the push button, and you can have accessible push buttons, okay? And when you push the button, a series of things happens that the light starts flashing yellow, then it goes to a solid yellow, then it goes to a solid red, then it goes to a flashing red, and then it goes back to out. So if you push the button, you start that entire sequence. And when it gets to the solid red for the vehicles, you would get an accessible pedestrian signal notification that you could cross to the splitter island. Does that make sense? Okay. So one countermeasure for APS for roundabouts is one of these pedestrian hybrid beacons, fairly expensive. Another countermeasure, very effective, is a raised crosswalk. The problem is getting cars to yield, right? So if you put in a raised crosswalk, cars will typically come in and they will start to slow down because they have to go over the bump. It's not a speed bump, it's a speed table. So you're walking on top of the speed table. And so a raised crosswalk is quite effective in getting cars to actually yield to you. A third type of solution is called a rectangular rapid flashing beacon, or RRFB. You may have seen these at crosswalks, particularly if you have a mid-block crosswalk on a long straightaway where cars have a long view of you. If you hit a pedestrian hybrid an RRFB and you push the button, and they can have accessible buttons with locator tones, that you push the button and yellow lights start flashing and alternating on a pedestrian signal. And if you have a nice long straightaway where people can see that coming, it can help get them to slow down and let them know that there's a pedestrian coming across the street. If they are accessible, when you push the button, it doesn't say walk sign is on because there is no walk sign. What it says is yellow lights are flashing. Now, yellow lights for drivers are not as strong as red lights, right? That's why when a school bus is pulling up, it flashes yellow and you can still pass it. But when it goes red, you have to stop for it. So when you push the button at an RRFB, it will say, the accessible part will say yellow lights are flashing. You still have to pay real close attention because cars run yellow lights, right? But it gives you some level of accessibility. If you combine these things and you have a raised crosswalk and an RIFB, you're in fairly good shape there probably. But you have to really, that's engineering study. You have to really check it out. But there's been some research that shows RIFBs are quite effective at getting cars to stop. I've seen ones that worked real well, and I've seen ones that I was not impressed with because of their location, including the ones in Morristown, by the way.
We have time for one more short question, Lucas.
Well, the questions can be short, but I tend to answer long.
What was the name of the movie from Hines?
It's called The Long Cane.
Okay. I'll look at it.
Hi, this is Sadie. I was wondering if you could talk about the volume of accessible signals, because I'm currently having difficulty getting volume set correctly. Mm-hmm. I know that they sometimes react to traffic noise, and I'm having a problem in my local intersection where they can't seem to get that calibrated correctly. So it's either like super quiet and I have to have my head right next to it, or maybe a big truck will go by and I can hear it for a second.
That's tough stuff, boy. You know, you'd think it'd be easy, but it's not. I don't know. There are two main brands of accessible signal in the U.S. One is called Polara and the other is called Campbell. I'm a little bit more familiar with the Polaras than I am with the Campbells, but I've seen both. New York City is doing both. And they're very tricky to set, particularly if you're in a region that has a lot of homes right around it, because they could become very sensitive. You know, if traffic engineers or the technician install the things loud, then you get a reaction from the neighborhood and you're really in trouble then. I often will tell people, get them installed off and then work with a traffic engineer and crank it up so you don't just piss everybody off. They're getting close to having sort of motion detection built in so that you can actually hear them when you need it and not the rest of the time, but it's not there yet, I don't think. I have a question that I need to ask some people about that. But it can be quite difficult. But also remember that they're called accessible signals because they're, as opposed to audible, because they also vibrate. So that if it's low, and you know, sometimes people also have hearing losses, and if you have to set those things so they can hear it, then they have to be really loud. You know, I'm not talking about even severe hearing loss. You've got a mild to moderate hearing loss, and to actually hear the locator tone in a congested neighborhood, you'd have to crank that thing pretty loud. So, but you can also use the vibrotactile component. They are very difficult to set right. But you have to, the Polara is pretty easy to set because they have basically an app on a phone that they can come and tweak, but it's a question of tweaking those things. Part of the variable here is how well the device is located. One of the nice side effects of all the work within the accessibility space within the Manual of Uniform Traffic Control Devices is that for the first time in, I think, 2009, there's a component of the language in the federal manuals that say, believe it or not, that say for the first time you have to put pedestrian push buttons where pedestrians can find the damn things. They hadn't thought of that before. And they're quite specific about where, how far they should be from the departure point. Now, it could be is your device well located near the departure point?
No. I actually, my town worked with me. I did a program. It's a long story, but my town worked with me to make a video that actually shows a lot of the challenges that I face as a pedestrian in my town. And I think it actually opened a lot of people's eyes, because that was also part of the problem, was where the curb cut is.
Yep.
Where you would actually cross the street is a decent distance from where they have placed that button. So just locating the button is an issue in the first place. And then if I were to stand there and put my hand on it to wait for the vibration, I'm, you know, a good set of steps away from that curb cut to then cross the street.
Well, let me ask you this. First of all, do you need the curb cut?
No, but the way that the way that intersection is set up, if I don't walk down to the curb cut, I could walk straight into a stopped car.
Okay. So there you know, there are lots of possible solutions there, including changing the paint, but the where they put the stop line, for example. You know, I don't know exactly what you're dealing with there. But the other thing is that the requirement is that when they may have to change the calculation of the timing of the intersection to include the distance from the accessible signal to the beginning of the crosswalk. So if they've got it, you know, 3 feet from the crosswalk, okay, that's one thing. But if it's 10 feet, then they might have to extend the timing on that intersection to allow you to get time to get from the signal to the corner to cross, which also may piss them off enough that it affects the timing of their crossing. And they might say, you know what, why don't we just put a pole in the right place and be done with this and make it
Okay. I'm going to send you the video.
Thank you very much. Don't send it to my CMI address, though, because I'm not there in a moment.
I'll get your contact info. But yeah, it was eye-opening for my town, I think. And they still haven't completely corrected the problem. And I think, you know, you have to squeaky wheel on that, I guess. But
if you've gotten anywhere, congratulations. I tell you what, this stuff can take a long time.
Lucas. Well, I finally got him to write parking tickets, so that was a big deal.
I think you can tell, Lucas, there's a lot of interest here, and so that only means you're going to have to come back for a cameo appearance and do this again a few months down the road, or maybe even make a trip up here to Maine and visit us all.
Kind of where I was going, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. The wood stove is nice. Anyway, thank you very, very much for spending some time with us this evening and providing such valuable insights.
Thank you.
Thank you for asking me.
Thank you.
This was fabulous. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Thank you very, very much, Lucas. This is Paul.
Very insightful. Thank you.
Great to see you again.
Yeah. By the way, Gene Shelberg says hello.
Thanks, Lucas.
Thank you, guys. Wonderful to seeing y'all. Take care of yourself.
See you.
Good night. Thank you.
Thank you. Sue, take care.
That was my vicious attack dog.
Jim, do you want to stop the recording?